Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We've been broadcasting on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, hot foot from the Veterans for Peace Conference in London, US Army vet James Toller. He's from the US branch of Veterans for Peace, and he's playing some of his music and talking about why he does what he does. Also, Jasper Tomlinson. He's a scientist, an octogenarian, and he's got a big idea that he thinks will a nuclear reactor which would cost a third as much as Hinkley C and much, much safer. It's the molten salt nuclear reactor. So why have these never been used? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also, through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Online, that's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or you can volunteer for anything, anywhere. The national do-it.org website. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But we start this week with James Toller. And I met up with him at a recent conference in London, Veterans for Peace organised. He starts by playing one song called One Day. And we hear a bit from him. And then he finishes off with his song, Money, Greed, Possessions.
Two generations lost, easy. We just do that to the war generation. Let's go teach those children how to be peaceful. You know, let's get it. Let's get into the society. If we're going to be part of it, we have to be in it to change it. We have two beautiful guys that play music with us, and they are examples of that. And I've been honored. So I see nothing but positive things for the, because where else are we going to go, right? Somebody said to me, the American election, I said, well, it was either catastrophe or disaster. We were going to react the same way. I'm happy to be part of it, and if anybody understands peace, it's probably somebody that's been to war a few times, or one time, or even seen battle, or had battle, or even the innocent that had it done to them. That whole spectrum of people, they're all part of veterans, because they had experienced all the stuff that was done to them. So I just believe it's time for change, and I see it happen.
Keep your baby warm. Free the mom all day. For, as you know, they leave your arms one day. Out in the world they will play. When I was just a wee of a lad, father said to me, all the trees around you, boy, they started with a seed. A seed is all you need. Seasons came and seasons gone. I grew up strong and lean. Father passed, mountain gray. I watched the world as it's been. Around and round and back again. Thank you. Father, keep your baby warm. Free from harm all day. For, as you know, they leave your arms one day. Out in the world they will play. Time will pass, all things must change. Like colors in the leaves, like the mountains that slowly melt to the bottom of the sea. So goes everything. So mother, keep your baby warm, free from harm all day. For, as you know, they go to war one day.
Hi, I'm James Toller, and I came over to support Veterans for Peace because I see the growth and the potential for this organization to bring change, mostly because everyone, I believe, has experienced combat in one way or another, even if it's just the institutionalization of the children through games and through leaving them an economy where they could not feed themselves and only have one path to go. It's so I see a lot of change in what's about to happen. You know, there's a good book out there that I just read a while back called The Orange Economy, which bases itself off of an economy of art versus economy of war and other means. All it did was it gave this the GDP of art. Okay, so the bankers can start lending us money to put on art shows. And if we do that, we can do what they did in like Washington, D.C., what they called gentrification. But basically it was ethnic shifting. And now those people are having to deal with that ethnic shifting. The ones that were the loudest voices were the ethnics that were the inner cities. And so when they got displaced, you know, we have what we have. So what we could do is learn from that model and take it to a different place. But so the orange economy, Artomatic, those are a couple things. If you Google those things, good things. They're moving and changing some of us, our society in America.
So, but what's your own story, though? Because, I mean, obviously, to see how to see your way through the kind of warfare economy, it does help to have actually experienced war yourself. That's probably a powerful motivator for people.
Right. I came in the Army in 1981 in September and enlisted as a paramedic. And went into paramedic school and special forces school, argued with an instructor and had to leave.
This is in the U.S., I tell you.
U.S. Army, yeah. But then I became a paratrooper and did paratrooping work and became a British paratrooper in the 80s, a Canadian paratrooper, and then also we got the Marine Corps wings and I was Halo. So I did all these operations and stuff with organizations around the world, and I saw what they were doing. I saw times where I had to find myself the champion of situations where, you know, you would have to intervene to stop some girl from getting raped or go in there, stop somebody from shooting civilian objects. I think that's what they called it. When we finally, you know, looked at the character and we stopped him from shooting out of a helicopter. So when I was in, I knew that, you know, if I got out, I felt guilty for not being there to stop it, you know. And so after being a paramedic, a medical pilot, I flew Huey helicopters in Somalia. After that, they selected me to go up to Alaska, and I flew up there. And then I became an airplane pilot, flew reconnaissance planes in Korea and other areas. Very nice, you know, modified versions of airplanes. And then went off to fly business jets in the end, you know, a paramedic and a pilot. The generals like you.
I mean, having actually been in the military, what does it teach you about what's really going on?
Oh my God, it's a farce. It should have been, I think it should have been called smoke and mirrors instead of shock and awe. But I don't know. I just, maybe I didn't invest well, you know. I should have invested in some of those warring companies, you know, when they were coming together, you know.
Well, apparently the stocks in the arms manufacturers in the States have gone up now, yeah. Just over the last week.
Well, of course, they're stocking up. I had a Canadian wife buy me a gun one time for a birthday present. I've never shot it, but it was really funny. She bought it because she could. She just came to America, bought a gun, and said, here, happy birthday.
I mean, you've got some, I think, some pretty clear ideas of a vision of a world without this necessity to keep invading. And yes. what do you make of the future? Because it's nice to hear someone who's got some positive ideas, because there's a lot of negativity around.
Oh, negativity. No, it's the children. They're going to inherit this, and they're going to change it. And it's our job to survive and teach them as long as we can. Just like Pete Seeger, when he started teaching our children in America about things, and they would not allow him to become into the public media broadcasting system that the government owned. So at the time, so now free media that we have, as long as you have a big enough server, I guess, is going to put you out there as far as you can, and your outreach is limitless, because now we got the people's pulse. We know, you know, there's a lot of lessons out there, and we all have something to teach, and that's the good thing, is we just have to get in there and teach it. I just spoke to a group of children between the ages of 14 and 21 on world affairs that went about an hour and a half. We had a physicist in there and a few other prominents to also listen to me speak, and they'll write me up a little letter for that. I'll be playing for their children next, some of the music. So getting in there and being part of it instead of resisting it. We have to do it in all spectrums. I understand that. Everybody, we got everybody out there, right? Let's make people aware. Let's do it. But I said, be the example, you know? You know?
Yeah, well, there's also people will point at us Brits and you Americans and say, well, actually, you guys are the problem.
Of course, we are the problem. Yeah, man, if you guys never came over there in the first place, the Indians wouldn't have... the Indians would have done this? Okay. Okay, I'm sorry, man. My genetics is two-thirds European, one-third Polynesian. You know what? What I'm saying is we have a lot, a long way to go. Americans 240 years old. Their constitution just ratified, you know. And I said, 240 years old? We haven't had a renaissance. Give us a break, you know. This is one of those things. You know, it's a young country. You know, look how barbaric we were 100 years ago. Yeah, and look at what we've done to the Indians. So it's a world war whether we even want to understand it or not. Everybody's affected. Economies are affected. Everything's affected in the world right now because of this world economy based on war. We don't want China to do the same thing. You know, come on. We Americans can't even fathom what it's like to, you know, walk a nice street like you guys do here, the average American. They can't even think what they can imagine about a Chinese. And I can't put them down. It's just that's the way their system went. You know, I was fortunate enough not to be totally in that system my entire life.
Anyway, how do people find your material? I suppose online it's going to be. It's not going to be mainstream media, is it?
No. Right now I own 80% of it. A friend of mine, he's from Denmark. We produced the first two works, and then Abbey Rhodes mastered both of them for me. The first time they invited me, I thought it was a joke. So I didn't even answer. And then the guy goes, hey, man, Abbey Rhodes wants to know. And then I went there, and guess what? They gave me a parking spot. And I took the bus because I just kind of showed up. I had to wait there because there's so many people outside taking pictures. And I just like, oh, shit, man. So I walked in, did my stuff. And I come out. It was so cool. Somebody later told me, you could rent that car space. Like, yeah, crazy. So, but, you know, just doing what I do, you know, it's having fun and being part of it. And I've been so fortunate in this pilgrimage that I've been on to try to help people and help kids and get the message of peace that, you know, I'm happy to have the opportunity to play for a lot more people and do a lot more for the people as this moves on. Because what else have I got to do, you know?
So how do we find you online?
You can find me at jamestoler, TOLER.com. That one you can get me on. And Reverb Nation, you can look up James Toler Kandahar. It might come up, or Kandahar Tags. You can, there's a bunch of ways I'm out there. I got like three Facebooks. If they're, you know, catch one that doesn't give you much action then.
I mean, one of the things you have to say, talking about music, is what's happened to music? You know, we had in the 1970s a lot of protest music, a lot of freedom in music and visions being brought out through music. What's happened to the music industry?
Oh, I took a music business class before I even started this project. I you know, the only part I got was the business end of it, and it was pretty sporadic because of the digital age. And ever since they stole the MP3 from those students that never got any commission for it. So all the other stuff that are going on, I say that now it's in the hands of the people. Now the problem is we're going to have to cipher through a lot of minutia, but there's a lot of contrived stuff going out there right now, and a lot of it is because these people don't have a lot of experience, but they have more money, so their ability to give the media is where it's at.
Money, greed, possessions, ambitions of man can exploit resources. You can devastate the land. There's people do that while others waste a day. When I was a young boy, my father, he said to me, boy, you can be anything, anything you wanna be. Just don't let your days pass you by. I said, do what you wanna do and say what you wanna say. Change if you want to and live for another day. It's your world, what you gonna do? Have no conscience. There's lovers of life whose ambitions have been smothered. There's people do that while others waste a day. When I was a young boy, my father, he said to me,
that was Money, Greed, Possessions by James Toller, and he's part of Veterans for Peace USA.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm Jasper Tomlinson, and I started a very long time ago with a degree in physics, and after doing my national service, it's that long ago, I went I worked for a year as a scientific officer at the building research station, and then I was actually £15 in debt. This is a very long time ago. I thought I had to do something. I went abroad, and I finally ended up in Kenya, travelling, and they said, why don't you get a job here? So I said, I really want a job. Oh, no, just talk to this person. And he said, we've got a vacancy for you. I'm testing building materials. So I said, I'm not too interested in that. Okay, what about hydrology? What hydrologist? Would you be a hydrologist? I said, what's a hydrologist? And they just didn't know what it was. And they said, oh, rivers, lakes, things like that. So I said, well, all right, that sounds better than building materials. And they said, start on Monday. That was Kenya Colony. And so I was a Kenya Colony hydrologist. And from that, I sort of went into a career in tropical water resources. And that went on until I finished, really, had enough of that. And in 2006, having more or less finished with my water resources stuff, back in England, I went to some meeting, and the man giving the talk, very clever man, Felix Pirani, a professor at King's College, London, and after the talk, we got talking about nuclear. I didn't know much about it, and I said, doesn't seem to be much use, it's too expensive. And he said, very, very gently, he said to me, do you know anything about thorium? And so I said, well, I know it's used for gas management, so I don't know much more. He said, I think you ought to find out more about thorium. And it put me on the track of what ended up as being a big, big interest in molten salt nuclear reactors. And from that, eventually, I got Innovate UK funding to do a molten salt reactor review and whether it would be suitable for the UK.
Well, okay, the obvious thing to ask is, what is a molten salt nuclear reactor? How does it differ from something like Hinkley C?
Right, well, let's go back right to before the atom bombs exploded in Hiroshima, and the very clever people who were doing this theoretical work for that at the Chicago Metallurgical Laboratory. When they finished their work, there was a mechanical problem, and so they were sitting back a bit after having worked very, very hard doing work. And they had seminars. And at one of these seminars, these very fellow Nobel Prize winners and people debated whether a nuclear device to harness this amazing atomic power for civilian use, whether it would be a chemical or a mechanical device. And they decided, there were several chemical engineers amongst them, that it would be a chemical device. And if it's a chemical device, they decided in the seminar that you would use liquid rather than solid fuels, because that's how you do chemical engineering, with liquids rather than solids. And so they said it would be a chemical device with a liquid fuel, and then they talked about what sort of liquid fuel, and they said, would it be a water solution of uranium nitrate or something? No, that doesn't sound like a good idea. It would be a molten salt. And so from that, they said, what sort of molten salt? And they thought, probably a fluoride salt. And so the idea of fluoride salts was there in the nuclear community before they even thought of building a reactor.
Well, look, hang on. Let me just stop you there.
Very clever people, Alvin Weinberg.
Let me just stop you there, because the obvious question at that point is, surely, the nuclear reactor and the whole nuclear process is so dangerous. If you've got a liquid or a gas, it's going to be surely more dangerous than a solid.
Right. Well, now we got to the heart of it. What was developed, and Weinberg had his signature on the on the patents, as well as the liquid fuel things. What was developed was the pressurized water reactor, the solid fuel pressurized water reactor. And it has an inherent risk. And the inherent risk is that when you react solid fuels, you get inevitably you get and it's at high pressure because it's water cooled, so it has to be very high pressure. And when you get very high pressure solid fuels, they have gaseous iodine and gaseous cesium in particular. And at very high pressures, if the containment ruptures, if the thing breaks open, then you get a release of a cloud of radioactive iodine, radioactive cesium, and it drifts about. And that is what happened at Chernobyl. And it's already been recognized a real risk at Three Mile Island. And if you look at the prices of generating stations, a nuclear power station was cheaper than a coal-fired power station until Three Mile Island. And then it started to get a bit more expensive. And Chernobyl, the inherent risk, became an absolutely apparent risk. That cloud of radioactive iodine and radioactive cesium drifted about over the continent. And everyone was pretty frightened. And so from that moment on, when you build a nuclear power station, you have to add layers of safety to contain this inherent risk.
Well, now, with the various accidents that people will remember, obviously Three Mile Island is one, Chernobyl is another. More recently, we've had the Fukushima disaster. All of those reactors were one sort or another based on this whole pressurised water reactor design. Why are they still using these?
Solid-fueled pressurised water reactor, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, why are they still using this pressurised water reactor design since it's been involved in all these three major nuclear disasters?
Well, you have to realise there's a big, big industry behind it. They know they have this waste to dispose of. They have to prepare the fuel. There haven't been many reactors built, actually, for the last 20 years. And that is because they became too expensive.
Well, surely the Chinese are building them, aren't they?
The Chinese can build them quicker, cheaper, and I think probably it is not a guidance for the world what the Chinese can do. I mean, if the Chinese can sell them to you, okay, you buy one, you've got one. But it's compared with the 1970s. A pressurized water reactor is extremely expensive. It's more expensive than a coal-fired power station.
Now,
that is the fatal weakness of the nuclear industry, is it's far too expensive.
Yeah, now, I mean, the one that they're building in Hinkley, we've have been hearing here in Bristol that we've got a serious problem with that, in that the costs of the insurance for the plant through its life, as well as the costs of decommissioning and dealing with the waste, are not going to be included by the people who are building it. That's to say, the Chinese and the French government. So the British government is picking up the tab for those. So, of course, that's going to massively skew the viability study for it. And it really isn't viable, but it looks like they're going to do it anyway because there's this kind of momentum behind it, which nobody wants to sort of say, well, no, we can't do that anymore, obviously at the very highest levels. And someone's been doing some pretty good lobbying on that. But I'd just like to relate to you a little story, if you don't mind, Jasper. And this was when I was hitchhiking in Ireland years ago. I got picked up by a fella who said, first thing when I hopped in his car was, oh, well, what do you do? He said, oh, I'm an insurance loss assessor. Oh, okay. And he said, oh, I've done some interval. I didn't really know what an insurance loss assessor was. He says, well, I go to the site of a disaster or whatever, and I will do my own report, which will just go to the insurance company. It's not a public report. And some of it will get published maybe and some of it won't. But he said, oh, I did the report for Three Mile Island, which I thought was quite an interesting chap to pick me up to have a lift. Well, I mean, I couldn't prove whether he was or he wasn't, but he seemed to know all about the disaster. So I think we just have to take him at face value, certainly to begin with. And he explained to me what he said had happened there, which was that the initial fire broke out in the link between the control room and the reactor itself, because what had happened was that there was this kind of pipe with all the electrics and mostly electromechanical devices that were in the reactor were operated by electrics from the control room. This all went through this great long pipe to the reactor from the control room. And some bright spark at some point in the past had come along and had a look at this pipe and said, well, hang on a minute. we've got all this insulation in this pipe, and in that pipe, the insulation is not fireproof. So if there's a fire breaks out, electrical fire in there, this insulation is going to catch fire, and it's going to, you know, turn into a critical fire, which will stop the people in the control room actually being able to manipulate the reactor. And so they had to scratch their heads and say, oh dear, what are we going to do about this? Because they had to completely possibly rewire the entire reactor or find a completely new system to control it. Anyway, another bright spark came along and said, well, hang on, if you were to evacuate the air from this pipe have a little valve where you could check to make sure that there was a vacuum. Once, if there was an electrical spark in there, it wouldn't actually be able to start a fire. And so they then allowed the reactor to start up again, having closed it down because they discovered this fire risk, after having evacuated the air from the pipe. Anyway, what happened was this worked fine for a few years. And then one day somebody was checking the valve, and they realised that the little needle in it had got stuck. So they thought, well, the best way to see if there's any air going in or out of this pipe is to use a naked flame. So they put a little match to the valve, and the match then, there wasn't, actually the flame got sucked into the valve and actually set the insulation inside this control mechanism on fire. So, I mean, I'm not sure if that's 100% true, but he certainly said that the most important parts of his report were never in the final Three Mile Island report. So it shows you these things are pretty inherently dangerous. So what would be safe about, you know, your type of reactor, about, you know, this idea of having a stable salt reactor, Multex?
Right. Let me set the scene. There's a problem with pressurized water reactors, solid fuel reactors. There's an inherent risk. Now, when you go to molten salts, the cesium and the iodine are stable salts. They have no vapor pressure. And a molten salt reactor works at atmospheric pressure. There's no possibility of an explosion like that. And nothing there is inflammable. The fluoride salts and so forth, the chloride salts, are not inflammable any more than table salt would be inflammable. And so you've got an inherently safe system. Now, that should make it possible to make a nuclear power plant much cheaper, because you don't have to add all these layers of safety. However, what the people have been doing with molten salt reactors is to copy what was done at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory when they ran a molten salt reactor in the 1960s. And there they had external plumbing with radioactive molten salts going through the external plumbing, a pump and pipes and things. And that today, then they weren't too concerned, but today, that would make it very difficult to make a safety case, and the thing might end up as expensive as a solid fuel reactor, although it would be inherently much safer. Now, if you do what Multex have done, and you use natural convection to transfer the heat, not, you don't have to pump anything, it's static. The fuel doesn't move about. It stays inside the container. It never comes out anywhere, and the whole nuclear island, as it were, is very, very compact right in the middle of the thing, and where you've got heat exchanges, there isn't any radioactivity. There's no neutrons. There's nothing, and so you can make the thing very compact, and you can make a really solid safety case, and then you can build them cheaper. And what Multex can do, and this has been verified by Atkins, one of the big engineering companies, quite independently, they looked at the costs that will have been involved with a Multex reactor, stable salt reactor, and they concluded that the cost would be about a quarter of, say, Hinkley Point C. And the electricity then comes down to being competitive with fossil fuels, even with gas. You're down to the sort of price of gas. And that makes nuclear a completely new possibility.
So who's been developing this Multex reactor, and are there examples running?
No, of course not. I mean, that's the whole point. You can't build This is the catch-22 about nuclear power. You can't build a reactor without more or less having built one before, and that therefore the first one is almost, you know, seems impossible. However, you can make, if you use a lot of the accepted technologies and embed them in your design, most of the things that need a safety assessment, you can say, look, it's been done completely safely somewhere else in the nuclear industry. And there's only a very little bit of it that needs to be demonstrated as being feasible, you know, that it will work.
Okay. What about the nuclear waste with the Moltex? Is there any benefit of the way that comes, rather than the Hinkley C and the Magnox and the AGR station, the Hinkley B stations?
Very good question. With solid fuels, you're doing quite well if you can burn 1-2% before the build-up of say xenon in the solid fuel pellets has reached the point where the criticality, where the reaction is killed off by this, as it were, poisoning the reactor. So with solid fuels, you're lucky if you can burn 2% of the fuel. 98% is waste. 98% of the radioactive material is waste. With molten salt reactors, because the molten salt is moving about, you can actually get rid of the waste products. You don't have any build-up of xenon. It bubbles out harmlessly. And so you can burn up to certainly 90% of the fuel. So immediately, your waste problem is reduced by at least a factor of 10. Also, you can alter the chemistry, the radiochemistry in particular, so that what you do get as waste is much easier to handle for disposal. That is to say, it's only going to need about 300 years of storage before it is virtually inert, whereas the waste from a solid fuel reactor takes tens of thousands of years to become inert. So not only do you have much, much less waste, when you really develop it, you have about a hundredth of the waste at the most. You also have much waste that requires far less lengthy storage before you can dispose of it into the environment. And so the waste problem is really addressed by using liquid fuels rather than solid fuels.
Well, it certainly sounds as if, I mean, because this is one of the major, most important problems with the nuclear reactors is the way that it's a kind of poison legacy for future generations. In fact, for, you know, hundreds of future generations to have to deal with the high-level nuclear waste. But look, the other side of all of this is many people will point the finger at the whole British nuclear program and say, well, it was only ever there to create plutonium for bombs in the first place.
Well, that's not quite true, although it would be true to say that the link between the military requirements and civil nuclear has always been a bit too close. But today you couldn't say that the reactors are there to breed plutonium for bombs. It wouldn't be true. But they do produce, solid fuel does produce plutonium, and what on earth do you do with it? And we've now got a big stock of plutonium, which is going to be terribly expensive to get rid of, except, and here's the next thing about liquid-fueled reactors. With a liquid-fueled reactor, the fuel preparation is very simple, and there is no problem whatever about burning plutonium as the fuel and getting rid of it, burning it up and totally getting rid of it. The problem that would arise, and why you can't do it worldwide, you know, planetary, for the planet, is because there is certainly a perceived problem in security risk of having, you know, the plutonium fuel hanging about. And so it can only be done where the security can really be ensured, which would be in the UK. It would probably be in Canada you could do it, but you couldn't do it, say, in Nigeria. And so the liquid fuel reactor for Nigeria would almost certainly have to be burning something other than than plutonium waste.
So is there actually really a black market in plutonium? Because I mean, surely it's, there needs to be some more work done on it in order to get it ready to go into a nuclear bomb.
Most of the plutonium in storage isn't ready for a nuclear bomb, though. But it would be... You only have to think what the headline would be in the Sun newspaper if terrorists got hold of a kilogram of the stuff. People would go, you know, be very, very upset. I mean, they'd panic in the streets if you were told it was in your locality. So this risk the risk has to be treated in such a way that really it doesn't create a problem. And that is very expensive. That means you've got to have armed guards everywhere. Everything's got to be very security conscious, which the actual existential risk of terrorists getting their hands on this material is very small. I mean, but the perceived risk would be huge. So you can't just say, you know, let's not worry about it. You have to be concerned. But the fact is that we can get rid of all this legacy waste by burning it up in a new sort of reactor, in a liquid-fueled reactor. We can burn most of the legacy waste, including the plutonium.
So, I mean, are there any governments in the world or universities that are really pushing this as an idea? Because it does seem as if the existing nuclear industry isn't really interested in liquid reactors.
Right. Well, what happened when the new Conservative government in May 2015, by November, they had formulated their energy policy, and they said they were going to do nuclear was going to be part of an energy mix. A lot of people were very annoyed about that, but it was to be a perfectly rational decision. And what they said is that because nuclear poses certain problems that you don't get with some of the other energy sources, nuclear has huge advantages that the other ones don't have: an amazing energy density, and it's sustainable for tens of thousands of years if you do it properly. And so it's got very many advantages, but there are certain problems about making the safety case. So the government said we will allocate £250 million to developing new nuclear, and what we will particularly focus on is what they call small modular reactors. Not these big ones like EPC, but much smaller ones where you put in one, and then if that worked well, you put another one beside it, and you build up your capability like that. And so the small modular reactor program was initiated by the government. It's still running, and people have submitted proposals. One of the proposals is a stable salt reactor. Another one is a molten salt reactor from the Canadian designer, and I think that if the adjudication of this competition as it's become is pretty level playing field, then this stable salt reactor will come out top because it's the cheapest. It offers the least expensive outcome for a power plant and least expensive electricity from a nuclear power plant.
What about fusion?
Fusion's a dream, and if it comes to reality, it will probably take over. But there's no feasible way of doing it in a way that will address climate change at the moment. No one can see that as being something that will be affordable and timely in terms of the problem we have, which is over the next 100 years.
And I mean, you can imagine a future, can't you? Future governments, etc., like the Germans have done, simply saying, "Well, we're not having any nuclear at all." Can you imagine that?
Well, of course, people are. I mean, the human race are lemmings. They race towards the cliff, hoping that they'll have a very nice big drop when they get there. And yes, I can imagine almost anything insane. But it would be extremely stupid for people to support that view.
So do you think the German government have been extremely stupid?
Yes. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. I know someone who gave a talk about molten salt reactors to an audience, and one of the audience was They came up afterwards and talked to, oh, you've changed my mind. I never realised this possibility in nuclear. Amazing. One of them was Angela Merkel's husband. And so he knew, and therefore she must have known, that a different way of doing nuclear was ready, was available, was ready to go. It needed proper, you know, proper commitment. And she realised that the German electorate would never vote her into power if she was supporting.
But you see, they've got a completely different policy for the future in Germany. They believe that, you know, people should have their own kind of power plants, if you want, on their house. Many, many Germans, most Germans, in fact, have got their solar panels. A lot have got wind generators, this sort of thing. So the idea is to scale the big power plants right down and to have power generated locally.
It's probably true, Tony, that a really wealthy country can manage without nuclear by doing all these things. But the real problem of the world is not Germany. It's not even, it's England. If England didn't exist, the climate change problem would hardly shift. It would shift by maybe a few months. But the real problem is places like Nigeria. Nigeria, a population of 160 million, a population growth rate of 3.5%. Why is it so high? Because they're poor. Why are they so poor? They don't harness any energy, useful energy. They cannot have a viable economic model because they lack energy. The amount of electricity generated into the grid amounts to 8 watts per person when I last looked. It's trivial, the amount that they generate. And all the electricity in Nigeria, if you get a hotel and things, it's all with standby generators, diesel generators. Nigeria, they cannot address global poverty. Their poverty. They have 100 million Nigerians living on less than about a dollar a day. And they have a birth rate, very high birth rate, because that's what goes with poverty. When people are wealthy, they stop having so many babies. They choose not to have so many babies. And so the big driver of climate change, which is population, excessive population in the world, 7 billion, going up to 10 billion, that, to reverse that, you have to address global energy poverty in order to address global poverty. And so the link is very clear. And all these things like tidal barrages and all these companies are completely inapplicable in a place like Nigeria, completely. And so Nigeria absolutely has to have something like nuclear power, which will be very difficult because it's not a very safe place to do anything. But it could be done because the footprint of a new nuclear power station will be tiny and it could properly be protected. And it would make a complete difference to the economy of the country. And Nigeria, all of Africa, South America, all these places, they absolutely have to have affordable, sustainable power supply in very, very large quantities.
Okay, for those listeners who are interested in this topic of energy, poverty, population, and technology, Jasper, can you recommend some websites or magazines, places to follow up this kind of thing?
Well, now you've got me a bit caught out. I bang on about it. I'm not quite sure where you do get that, actually. I mean, that is one of the problems, that the people who are really successful with the publicity are Greenpeace, who are, to my mind, are completely irresponsible about this. They talk about, say, tackling climate change by using less energy. I mean, that is a poisonous rhetoric. What you're saying is, let the rest of the world stay poor in order to save the planet. It's an obscene idea, and it's not going to work.
So what about the molten salt reactor, though? Doesn't the Moltex patent, do they have some kind of website?
Absolutely, yes. www.moltexenergy.com. And you've got six PDFs that tell you all the technology. They've got stuff about the business case. You've got a very, very good website there. And also, if you go on their website, you will find my MSR review report that I got Innovate UK funding to do. And that was released in July 2015. So it's quite up to date. And it gives you a review of what there was when we looked in 2015, and the situation has changed a lot since, so there's much, much more available now.
So what's your honest prediction then? When are we going to see one of these in operation?
What my honest prediction is that it will be difficult to do it in the UK. You go to the UK government, you say, let's do it. And they say, well, right. And you say, well, okay, give me a site. Ah, very interesting. Okay, let's talk about that. And then you say, and the other thing is, I want to talk to the safety inspector. Yes, yes, well, you really put your finger on it there. We really haven't got enough of them for you to be able to talk to one. And so in the UK, it is very difficult. Go to Canada, it's completely different. Now, the problem with Canada, there is a problem, is that the electricity there in Canada is about the cheapest in the world. So to get investors to build the first of these reactors in Canada means you have to have something a bit more clever than just trying to sell the electricity problem to the a molten salt reactor is an excellent way of harnessing energy to give you industrial heat, because the molten salt reactor works at much, much higher temperature than the solid fuel reactor. So you can use the heat from a molten salt reactor directly to help you make things like cement. You can use it to synthesize motor fuel with perfectly routine chemistry. And so someone has to be thinking a bit clever to be able to do it in Canada because of the investors who would have to have a market.
Look, come on, I'm going to pin you down. How long do you think and where? Give just a guess.
Right, well, I believe that in 10 years' time, and I'm going to live to see it, and I'm 87, so I have to 200, but in 10 years' time, there will be one either started up or just about to start up, probably in Canada. But hope that the best thing would be in the UK, because when you've got one going, an industrial prototype, say, one gigawatt industrial prototype, then there's a huge market in these things. An enormous industry to the UK if we can do it here. But here is the real difficulty, Freddie. There are no votes for a government in getting their nuclear policy right. You cannot do it in 5 years. The government cannot do it in one term. And basically, people are not going to say, oh, I'm going to vote for them because they've got their nuclear policy right. And so the government has to do it as a commitment to humanity. And that's pretty hard. That's a pretty big ask for the government. Does that make sense?
Yep, okay. Jasper Tomlinson, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, US Army veteran James Toller, and also to scientist and octogenarian Jasper Tomlinson. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897, or prsc.org.uk. Also through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Even the Volunteering National site, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.